I want to welcome you back to Dream Chasers Radio with me, your host, Yaya Diamond. What's up, peoples? I had to do a little different this time. I got you, didn't I? I got you. Anyway, so listen, we got a return guest today, and he's feeling so much better, and I'm so happy to have him back in great health. Mr. Brian Taylor is here with us today. We're going to be talking about mental health and his books and how it's helped him to kind of overcome all the things that presented themselves to him during that time. So welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Awesome. So we're, if you haven't seen the beginning, if you haven't seen the preliminary review, then you need to go back and look at it, because we're moving on from here. Okay. We're moving
on.
So tell me, okay, so let's go into that mental health aspect of everything. And let's start from, you know, point where you realized that this was not going so good.
So I was about 15, 16, and I realized that I wasn't living what you would call a normal childhood. And I saw how other parents were with their children. I was like, that's not normal to me. I mean, I get a good slap for nothing. I get downtrodden and beaten down verbally and physically by my mom and stepfather. And then, you know, I started to act out. And then as I got older, you know, my mental health started to wane a bit. You know, and just imagine the daily put downs, you know, just being broken down to you're literally nothing. And when you get yourself back on your feet again, they do it again. And it wasn't until I was much older, when I left home, I realized how bad mentally I was feeling, how, I wouldn't say insecure, I would say how I was mentally unprepared for the world. Because I thought I wasn't prepared for people to be kind. I wasn't prepared, you know, if you get my meaning, I wasn't prepared for genuine people to be, hey, Brian, are you okay? You know, actually care. And, wow. And, you know, and that influenced my attitude toward people. That influenced my writing in a lot of ways. You know, again, as a young kid, I would escape into writing, and I did that in my as a young adult. It was escapism at its worst, in a way, but down the road, it's helped me a lot. Mm-hmm. So, Wow. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, getting to that point where you realize that this was not normal. Okay. Yeah. But you thought it was all that time?
Yeah. From the age of, my stepfather came into my life, my sister's and my brother's life, when I was about 7, you know, and my brother was only 3 or 4, and my sister was 6, I think. And things were fine to begin with. And then things started to change when I came out of these foster care homes. And, you know, my mum and stepfather took my sister and my brother and left me in care. And then I was only out for a few years before I sent back into care. And again, I thought that was normal. You know, I was always told that I'm the problem child. But then the people that looked after me, these foster care homes and places, said, you know something, he's not a child that has issues, he's a child with a problem. He's a child that is being abused, but I still sit back into that situation, you know. And it was like, first signs for me were my stepfather cancelled Christmas when I was 11 years old. So he decided that Christmas would be used for educational purposes. So we would get an educational gift at Christmas. You know, he didn't believe in Christmas. You know, I used to love it as a kid, love getting gifts, getting up in the morning, that, you know, that excitement you get at 5 in the morning, waking up your mum and dad, come on, you know. That changed when I was 11. And we went from having like Christmas dinners to sausage and chips. You know, it's just everyday food. And when I met my husband, I had my first Christmas. In my late 20s, I had my first Christmas, and I celebrated for the first time. I was like 25. And I tell you, I went through 2 boxes of Kleenex because everybody bought me gifts. We had a Christmas dinner. I was crying. I bought them nothing. I didn't realize that Christmas was for that. You know, I was so used to not celebrated it, so used to not being wanted, you know. And that's, for me, was when I started realizing there's, you know, looking back, hindsight was when things started to change for me mentally, where I wasn't prepared to not be loved, if you get that meaning. It's, you know, and it had an effect on me in relationships, you know, because when people are kind, I'm like, hey, why are you being kind? Why are you buying me flowers? I mean, the first time my husband bought me flowers, I called him a creep. Why? You know, and he was so offended. He threw the flowers in the sink and walked out. I wasn't prepared for that kindness. You know, now I'm older and wiser.
Wow.
I don't know right from wrong and how to treat people, you know.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, you know, you were in it so long that you didn't even realize that that wasn't normal. And then when you did get the normal or the respect, you thought it was disrespect.
Yeah. Yeah, I was.
That's crazy.
It was what I had. A friend of mine when I was 18 said, what you're living in or what you're living through is crazy. Because I got a place at university at Aberystwyth in Wales to study landscape archaeology, because that was my passion. And I got a full scholarship, 2 years at school, and my teachers and my tutors from college wrote checks to get me through the first year as a thank you, because I was the only person to get through a two-year course with them. Wow. My stepfather told me that I wasn't allowed to go to university, that I was to cash the checks, give them to him, and stay at home and look after him and my mother.
And did you do that?
I did.
Oh my gosh.
I gave up university because I thought that was what I had to do to show my love for them. And then a friend of mine told me shortly after, he said, you need to get out of that place and get away. So I moved to London. And that's when my attitude slowly changed. That's when my mental health really kicked in. Being alone and seeing, I was conflicted with the kindness from others, and going out to gay bars and meeting genuine people was hard for me to accept. I mean, why would you want to buy me a drink? Why would you want to ask me out on a date? I mean, what are you after? So that influence really took a really hard hold on my heart in a way, because I was very closed off, very walled up. And even to this day, me and my husband have been together for nearly 16 years, and we still are taking down those walls. Even now, even the slightest thing he could do or say will set me back to when I was a kid, and I'd be terrified that something's going to happen. At 41 years old, the trauma I went through, this man beat me. He tore me down. My mum helped him. I would tell her that he hit me, and she would hit me for telling her that he hit me. He had such a hold over my mother for 17 years before she passed. Yeah. And my little brother, when I left home, he was the only one left, and all the attention went from me to him. And he put cigarettes and matchsticks out on my brother's arm. He once said to my brother, how many times can a match burn? And my brother said once, it went wrong twice. He lit it and put it out on his arm. So my brother has little scars on his arm. And this man got away with it. We reported, when I was older, I reported the abuse, physical, mental, and sexual abuse to the police. And they said, it's an old crime and there's nothing that they could do.
What?
Mm-hmm. Because there's no physical evidence anymore. But my brother, myself and my sister collaborated. It was, they all had similar stories that I was unaware of. Mm. You know, because the police spoke to them and they did nothing. It was like, I lived in Canterbury with my husband at the time. So I had to go to the local police station there, because I was having therapy and this memory that I'd blocked so far back in my head came through, and it was I don't know. I mean, he raped me when I was 15. I'm sorry, but so And it turns out he did similar things growing up. I'm sorry. And when I remembered that and I reported that, there was nothing. They did a 6 month, maybe a year investigation. The Crown prosecution got involved, only to be told that there's nothing that they could do. You know, wow. And the man now lives in my mum's home with the girlfriend he moved in 3 months after my mum died. That's, you know, any inheritance that my brother and sister should have had, he had her change her will and had it witnessed by friends of the family, you know, so.
Oh my gosh.
I believe in karma.
That's still going to go back to him. And I said in the nice way, okay, that's gonna come right back around. I mean, but literally, that's terrible. I'm so sorry that happened to you. And, you know, in the United States, there's a statute of limitations, but it also kind of goes from the day that your memory comes back. Because they know here in the United States that, you know, suppression is, you know, it could go for years and all of a sudden, boom. So that person can be tried and convicted off of that memory.
Well, I saw it a few years ago when it was, I think it was a Catholic priest, and these boys that he'd abused started to remember. And when they did that 15, 20, 30 years, more people started coming forward because they started remembering. Yeah.
And guess what happened? He got prosecuted.
Yep.
And he got put in, you know, he got prosecuted. He got put in jail, I think it was. I think he got some time. He had to serve.
Yeah, he was defrocked. So. He was defrocked. He was no longer a priest.
That's right.
He was. I think the Vatican could only defrock or whatever you call it, like no longer make them a priest. That you has to come from the Pope itself, and the Pope did that. I mean, but like in the UK, it's in a way, it's like your word against his, and that's how it was. And he turned around and said, "Hey, they've always hated me. They're making things up." I said, "Okay."
That's sick.
I know the truth.
That's sick. But you know what's, you know, this is the big thing about it, because when I was young, I was molested. And, you know, I found out that the same person was molesting another young lady. And I called the police station and I told them. And I knew he went on to be a sexual predator. He was in jail and he died. But he died because he was old. Okay. Yeah. But it was just, you know, that it just comes right back around. Just comes right back around.
You know, it's karma.
You know,
and that's why I told you that I live by four rules: love, dignity, respect, and, you know, loyalty. I'm older, wiser, and if I could go back in time and stand, and even though when as a kid I was standing up for myself and still getting a beating, I would tell somebody I needed help.
Yeah.
You know, and if anybody watches this, if they are, get help. You tell a friend, you tell a family member, you tell anybody that you trust.
That's right.
Get help. And there's plenty of ways you can do it, online, over the phone. Just speak to me, a guidance counselor at school, anybody that will protect you and get you to the people that will look after you.
Yeah.
And I'm against any sort of abuse to any child, whether they warrant it or not. I mean, I grew up in an era where it was okay to give a child a slap on the leg, but, you know, not dislocating your stepson's shoulder and then popping it back in, then taking me to the hospital, said I fell off my skateboard. You know, it's, honestly, he would punch me on the tip of my nose right here. So it would never break it. It would punch me right in the tip, so it would bleed. I make my eyes water. Or he would choke me, wait for me to pass out. I mean, I was never good at school because I didn't care, because what I went through. I didn't care about academia. I didn't care about math, English, anything. So I wouldn't do well at school. I'd much rather be the class clown and get some sort of attention and then stand outside the headmaster's office for the rest of the day. And I got home one day and he decided, I don't know if I've told you this, but they put my hand in the car door and slammed it. And to this day, my little finger is crooked. and he set it. He set it with two ice cream sticks, you know, like two like coffee stirrers. He set it for me. Mm-hmm. I know it's a little intense. I apologize, but
no, I mean, this stuff that goes on that some, I mean, oh my gosh, really?
Mm-hmm. This is why I jumped so deeply into my writing as a kid. It was, I could create a world where people would love me and accept me. And, you know, I remember a time, I was in my 20s, I was an armed civilian working in Iraq, Afghanistan, and I came home on leave. And I always felt it important that I go spend a week with my mum. You know, no matter what, she is my mum, I still loved her. I would spend a week in the house. And one night, this guy, my mum would drink. She was epileptic. She'd had numerous strokes. So she wasn't a well lady. So if she had alcohol, he would have to buy it for her because she couldn't walk 3 steps without collapsing. She was pretty bad, wheelchair bound sometimes, you know. And I went there one night and he gave her a big glass of hard cider. And she took 15, 16 of her tablets with that hard cider, you know, and she passed out. He got her to bed, and I'm sat in the living room, and he'd gone through half a bottle of scotch, and he decided when he got up to give me a punch, which I moved out the way from, and for once I was like 22, 23. I hit him so hard, the drunken ass fell back onto the sofa, and he never struck me again.
That's good.
And I don't condone any type of violence.
Yeah, but no.
He didn't strike me again.
No, that, good.
But it was just more verbal after that, you know? And again, I left that night. I went back to London, spent a few days in London before I was back on a flight to Afghanistan again. Wow. You know? It just got to that point where I felt I deserved more.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, again, I apologize. I do go on.
Now that is, no. But I mean, we're talking mental health here, and this is what happened, you know, in certain homes, and we need to be attentive. I mean, why didn't the teachers see this? Why didn't they say something? Why wasn't this brought to the attention of the authorities by people who were seeing this happen? I mean, so many people ignore things like this. Why are we ignoring this?
Because,
you know, this is terrible.
I mean, I had a label of the problem child, the problem student. I was always fighting at school, and because the only way I could express my hurt was picking fights with other people. I was never a bully, but if someone bullied me, I would respond to somebody my age because I knew I could. I mean, I was always, unlike now, I'm overweight and, you know, old. When I was younger, I was skinny, but I knew how to throw a punch. And I had a good teacher. And I was getting suspended. And the teachers, you know, would get fed stories by my mom and stepdad. Hey, he's like this at home. We don't know what to do with him. Then I'd go back into care. Then I spent 3 years in an all-boys home. It was called Garth House. And one side was a boys' home, the other side was a girls' home with a shared school. I lost 3 years of, what would you call it? High school, you have those levels you get educated to. I lost 3 years of that in, so for us, years 7, 8, and 9
right,
is like 11 to 12, 12 to 13, 14 to 15. It's like, that's how we do it. So
right.
I lost 3 years of what we would call secondary education. And because this school didn't do anything, they just gave you a book and you copied out of it. And then I was behind on that, which just added to everything. And there's one thing my English teacher said at that home, as well as my high school, he's got a great imagination. One day he might be a good writer, which my mom and stepfather jumped on and said, he's just making things up. Don't believe him, he's telling lies. You know, and people, you know, would believe what they were saying because I would act out if I was verbally attacked or, you know, I would try and defend myself. I would verbally say something back. If I was called a horrible name at 13, 14, I wouldn't think twice. But one of my friends came for dinner. I was 16 years old. His name was Matthew. And he saw how my mother and stepfather were with me. Mm-hmm. You know, and he said, you've got to tell someone. And at that young age, you've got to tell somebody. I said, why? There's nothing wrong.
Wow. Wow. But you are an amazing writer today.
Oh,
and
I hope.
And you know, your teacher was right on point. She was right on point. So tell me about the books and how the books helped you emotionally, you know, to and you know, mentally to get through these times and to get to where you are today.
Again, escapism. I could create a world where I felt safe and secure, where nothing could hurt me in that world unless I wanted it to.
Right.
And I'll go to bed at night, imagine these worlds, I'd write them down. And I stopped for a while in my early 20s, like 19 to 20, 21. I stopped kind of doing that. And it wasn't until I met my husband and he read something I'd written in 2006. And that's when I started the Dark Leash series. And he said, maybe you should complete that book. And that one book led to the second, third, fourth, and fifth. And for me, I'm able to put down my raw emotion. And like some of the chapters are so dark, then some of the chapters are very light and happy. And, you know, I think every writer has a story. I think every writer has to put emotion and realness and, you know, to some aspect, real life issues that they've been through.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was able to do with these books. I was able to put down all that. Hate's a horrible word, but I was able to write down all that hate and anger and frustration I have into some of the characters.
Mm.
And in a way, it was therapeutic for me. Mm-hmm. And these books, they might be sci-fi, they might be action, might be adventure, but it's a celebration of emancipation from pain and suffering. That's what it is for me. These books mean something to me, that if somebody likes these books and reads these books and can relate a little bit to any of the characters,
mm-hmm.
that's like a piece of string leading me to them. Mm. You know, it's a connection. And every book is a connection to my heart. And, you know, a friend said, oh, you should sit down, do a biography, write down some mental health books. So that's not me. You know, it's, this is me and I'll do me. Right. I'm not gonna have anybody tell me how it should be anymore. This is me. And I leaned more into writing after I was outed. My sister did that. Outed me out of pure anger. She just outed me. And she, you know, never apologized for it, which I really don't care. I don't talk to her anymore. I've tried. And it's sad because, you know, she's a year younger than me. Then my brother's the youngest, you know. And it doesn't matter how hard you try, you know, it was always me that had to apologize. And I was like, not anymore.
Right.
And these books just represent that you've got to be tough. You've got to be who you're meant to be, not if, buts, or maybes. You can just be true to who you are. And, you know, I think everybody's a writer in one way or another.
Yeah.
You've got your stories. I've got mine, you know, and it's how you want to express that. And I express it in a sci-fi instead of a, you know, a help book, you know, like there's so many. But I did it in a sci-fi. I expressed, you know, because I could create characters that were angry and hateful and characters that were kind and loving and genuine and stubborn. And most of those characters are me, because doesn't matter how much therapy you get, you still hold that resent.
Yes.
You know, here. And it lives with you. But over time, I've had 20 plus years now to address those issues.
Mm.
older and wiser, as they say.
Right.
And, you know, that's how I live now, and that's how I want to live. And I just, you know, don't have time for that hate.
Yeah.
And if I see it, I express it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. If I'm in a restaurant and I see somebody being rude to a server, or I'm like, hey, come on.
That's right.
Stop.
Speak up. That's right.
You got to speak up. If something doesn't look right, say something. You know, it might not be a business, but hey, that's the, you don't talk to someone like that. No, stop. Yeah. And that's, I frustrate so many people when I do that, but we all have that button that can be pressed, and you got to say something.
Yes, we got to say something. And yeah. I love what you've done. I love that you've taken that and put it in a book that you understand that you can heal yourself from. So with that in mind, okay, so these books have helped you tremendously, but what is the biggest way that you've been helped by your books, by writing these books, by going through these things? What is the biggest thing that you say that really you don't have an issue with anymore?
I think hate. I don't hate my mum. I mean, she's passed now. I don't hate my stepfather. I feel sorry for them. And I think getting that hate out led me to have more room for love of myself and my husband and our partner. It just led us to, you know, led me to be more open and with myself, with my feelings, because I didn't realize how much hate I was holding inside me. And you do, you hold on to that. You hold on to that hurt. And for me, the first three books, first book, you know, is pretty much introduction, but the second and third is my worst period of, they took me 3 years to write. They might be short, but they took me 3 years. But at the worst point of my life was about 4 or 5 years ago. And all that hate and hurt was put into those books. And I can't tell you what a weight it was. Mm. It was just lifted. It was gone. And I felt happier.
Wow.
And lighter. And my husband noticed a difference. I noticed a difference. My aunt in the UK noticed a difference. I mean, she's my last connection to my family. You know, she's my mum's sister. And as far as I'm concerned, my auntie is like my mum. We lost contact for a long, long time because of my stepfather. He moved us away. And my mum and him told me that my nana, my mum's mum, was dead. Mm. They weren't. When I left the house at 19, I thought, I'll go pay my respects. And I remembered my nana's address, knocked on the door. I had a heart attack when she answered.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. And to be told that they knew I was gay, my mother had rang, and that my mother would ring my nana once a week. So for 12 years, my nana was dead. I had no family. I was like, okay. You know, and my auntie and I have reconnected. She's the most genuine, beautiful person ever. My last connection to my family, you know, and she's just an amazing lady, and she's been so supportive and loving. You know, I call her at least 3 or 4 times a week, you know, on the Facebook thingy. And we have 30-minute conversations some days hour conversations, if not longer. You know, it's nice having that connection back. And she knows what I went through, my stepfather, and she supported me all the way. And she told me, all the way, you don't need to hate.
Yeah.
You got to let it go. Because it'll weigh you down, and it'll make you feel that hate ages you. It'll make you ugly. All that hate inside will show on the outside. You know, and I looked haggard a few years ago, and now I'm happier. I'm feeling healthier, apart from the hips and the COVID, granted, but I feel healthier and lighter. And again, I go on. I could talk for hours with you, Yaya. You're so easy. You know?
Well, I appreciate it. You know, going through your story, going through why you wrote the books, how the books have helped you. You know, a lot of people need that outlet. Maybe it's not a book. Maybe it's audio. Maybe it's writing things down. Maybe it's helping others. Maybe it's volunteering. It could be whatever you feel is going to help you get through, you know, whatever you've gone through to get to the other side. It just, you have to do it. My gosh, I am so, so proud of you, Brian. And to come where you come such a long way, and you've gotten rid of hate. You know, that is a very hard thing to do.
It is. And I think it comes with age as well. You've got to learn. My auntie says this, pick your battles.
Yeah.
And she said, you're never going to win a battle with hate. No. Hate will always take over and win. You might win the war,
but you can't win
occasionally, but you can't win all the time with hate. And I take that and I understand that. And she's right. You know, you can't win a battle against hate. You can't win a war against hate.
Nope.
You know, you might fight a truce here and there, but you've got to let it go.
Yeah.
And I have regrets in my life. I also have a lot of happiness from making some of someone's regrets right. Mm-hmm. And it's the smallest things, like an apology. You know, you may not feel responsible for something with a family member, but, you know, maybe you did do something and, you know, an apology, whether it's a small or big one, it goes a long way. And then those regrets turn into, hey, why don't we meet for coffee? And that's what I do. And I would advise anybody with any issues, just talk it out. And if you have young adults, male, female, trans, gay, anything that are listening to your podcast that can relate in some way to what I'm saying, that need help, get help. Speak to somebody. Speak to a family member. Speak to somebody you can trust. Speak to your guidance counselor, your teacher, and tell them that you need help. Because the first thing that they will do is call the police and a social worker. And they will, and it's their job to protect you, mm-hmm. you know, and they will, you know, but you've got to be honest and realize that, you know, it's not okay to be smacked around. It's not okay to be verbally abused. It's not okay to be touched in any way whatsoever, sexually, physically. It's not right. Say something. Because at the end of the day, you've got to live with that. And I lived with a lot of regret because I wished I had the courage when I was 11 to do that and protect me and protect my brother and sister. Because as the eldest, that was my job, that was my duty. And I hold a lot of responsibility. And to somewhat, I think they hold a lot of resentment because I got away from it. You know, I moved away from it. And I left them behind. But that's how they see it. But I had to look after me for a while. So you can't help anybody.
No.
When,
and especially when they're little like that. I mean, they were underage. You were able to move and get away. And there was really, truly nothing you could do without reporting it. And even if you did report it, they wouldn't go to you because you didn't have the finances to take care of them. They would be back in the system.
And the thing is, at that younger age, it would have been, well, Brian, you know, you have made things up. And that, yeah, I never made things up. It was that he's angry at us. You know, Alan, which is my stepfather's name, had to give him a slap the other day because he ate an extra candy bar. You know, one time I ate a candy bar out of the fridge while asking for it. Right, I got the handle of a cooking knife, whacked at the tips of my fingers. That way, I'd never take a candy bar again without asking. You know, as is, I hate cornflakes with a passion, because at a young age, my mum would buy the cheap brand of cornflakes and the cheap brand of this. It's called UHT milk. It's like pasteurized milk. It's like long life milk. It doesn't have to go in the fridge. It can sit on the counter for a few weeks and still be good. They would buy that and that milk And they would give me a bowl of cereal every day before school. I wouldn't eat it because it tasted nasty. That bowl would still be sat there that night for my dinner. Out in the, not refrigerated, out on the dining table, all soggy and sour.
What did you do?
They would force me to eat it. And if I, again, I don't mean to graphic, if I threw it up, they would try and make me eat that too. To this day, my husband eats cornflakes. I make him go to the bathroom and rinse his mouth out with bleach. He's not coming near me. I hate the smell. Sorry. I'm not making it up.
This is sick.
This is sick. You know?
Brian, I am so sorry you went through that.
The thing is, you don't need to be sorry. It is what it is. I live with that now. And, you know, it's funny because a few months ago at Christmas, I did a 4-week stand-up course over at DC Improv. And I was going to go on stage and talk about this, and make people laugh, because I could turn anything into a funny moment, and I scripted it. I was going to talk about it. I bombed because I scripted it. It didn't feel normal. I just tried to do what I could do. Nobody laughed. I was like, okay, whatever. And my husband said, it's don't script it. Just talk.
Yeah, you know? Gross.
Honestly,
I don't think my face is gonna be normal for a while.
I used to hate, try this for your kids, right? This is what my mom and stepdad would do to me if I didn't tidy up my room. I would come home from school and my bedroom would be moved, like bunk beds. They would dismantle them during the day, bring it down into the front yard, reassemble, remake the bed outside with my desk, with my computer on it, bedside table, set of drawers, and they would lay out all the clothes that I hadn't put away in the same place on the grass. And even though I would have to come home from school and do homework, I would have to deassemble the bed, take it upstairs, make sure my room was clean, reassemble everything, put my laundry on, because I had to do my own laundry at 11 years old. I was able to iron by the time I was 11 and a half, I could iron a nice crease to my arms, nice crease to my trousers. They would just do all that to teach me a lesson. And then I'd be up to 3-4 in the morning doing my homework. It might work for your kids. I don't know.
No, it don't work for my kids. They be outside on the bed.
Honestly, I would come home to that from high school.
No.
All the neighbors laughing. Oh, did you not clean your bedroom again, Brian? Well, apparently. And it could be like one sock on the floor. Or I didn't do the military corners of my bed. Which to this day, I still do here now. At 41, I drive my husband crazy. Because if he doesn't make the bed the way I like it, I'm like, nope, strip the bed, let's do it all again. And I'll make sure I do the military corners. And that's kind of stuck with me.
Wow.
It's one thing I can't get out of doing. It's, I'm sorry.
That's okay, Brian. Well, we're gonna be talking about your books again, but where can people find you and where can they find the books to read?
So
Maybe they need this.
They could go on to www.darkleash.com. And, it's Dark Leash, as in dark, LEICH.com. Or they could just go on Amazon and type in Dark Leash on Amazon, and it'll come up on there. I mean, they can follow me via Instagram and Facebook. I mean, all the links from my Facebook, on my website, and I'll be posting these videos on there along with my trailer. And I even have my email on there. So if somebody wants to reach out and have a chat, I will personally respond to them. If somebody needs help, I'll be there. I'll do what I can. It's, you've got to help people.
Yeah.
And I don't care.
I'm still on the cereal part.
I don't care if I'm in Virginia. You could be in Idaho. You know, you send me a message. I'll chat. If I can make you feel better, even for a brief second, I will do that. You know, it's I want to help whoever I can help, especially if you have a cornflake issue, you know, that we can relate to.
And I like cornflake to begin with, so that just didn't sit well with me.
I can't. Right now, my husband has bought a box. It's on the kitchen counter, and you know, and it's still sealed. And you know how tempted I am to wrap it in Gorilla Tape. And if he really wants it, he's got to.
Oh gosh! No, I think the only cornflakes I like are Special K because they have like the crispy little bubbles on it. And as long as it stays crispy, I'm good. So it's like, okay, I'm not gonna put milk on it until I'm ready to eat it.
That's the only time if I'm going to do it, it's going to be eaten. I'm not going to
right put the
milk in and then make a coffee. It's gonna
No. It can't be soggy. Not even one. Because if it's one, I won't eat it. Mm-hmm. I won't eat it. I can't do it.
I'm a fan of like those wheat biscuits with the sugar on top. Yeah, the milk too, the shredded wheat type thing.
Okay. Yeah, I like those. Yeah.
I like them. Because I don't mind them a little soggy because right. You know, it still tastes good and they don't right. smell
but bad. Cornflakes does not taste good when it's soggy. I'm sorry guys, but all you cornflake lovers out there that had stuff soggy, just take it in the other room. No. Yeah.
Maybe I should set up like a cornflake therapy group now. You know, yeah, I've just given you some PTSD, haven't I? You know, like
yeah. Okay. We gotta go, guys. Thank you so much. I'm gonna have you back on the show. We're gonna be talking more about his books. You can go to darkleash.com or you can go ahead and go in the description box below and it'll be there, guys. And I wanna thank you guys so much for tuning in. And Brian, we got some more stuff we need to talk about. Because man, cornflakes is just not gonna settle. We just can't do this.
Yeah.
That's nasty. Oh, all right, guys. I don't mean to be mean or nasty. For all you cornflakes lovers out there, go ahead and do that. Okay. Until next time, guys. Don't forget to dare to be different and don't be eating soggy cornflakes.
Bye.
Please. Oh. All right, guys. Bye. Oh, that's so gross.
Yeah.
You are kidding!
I dare to be different. I dare.